Hey,
Mark.
How are you doing? Nice
Fine.
To meet you.
Fine. It's nice to actually get to talk to you in person.
Yes. Oh, we talked on the phone before.
For Gifted, yeah.
Yeah.
And once again, Mark, once again.
Did you like this?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I am in love with this film.
Oh, great.
I'm utterly charmed.
Oh, amazing.
The creativity here in Alan's story.
Uh-huh.
But then what you did with it from a visual standpoint, you are such a visualist when it comes to using metaphor to tell a story. And here, between what you and Stuart does.
Yeah,
and
who I worked with on Gifted as well.
Yeah. What the two of you do here with creating the visuals, the pockets of life that really capture what New York was back in the 70s.
You know,
that vibe is gone.
Mm-hmm.
The vibe that you guys capture here are those little pockets.
Mm-hmm.
The Lower East Side, the West, Upper West Side, and they're the not the usual places we see. So you really capture the texture and fabric of the life of each of these characters, which sets up some of the great dynamics with Thomas battling with Ethan.
Yeah.
And how he meshes with WF.
Yeah, there's the movie, what I say about it, like, it's not a contemporary New York. It is New York that I imagined New York to be before I ever came to New York. You know what I mean? Like, there's a kind of a fabulistic quality to the city, and we tried to take out, you know, we didn't make it, there's not really a lot of cell phones or social media.
Right.
There is a romantic idea of what this place is, and we took the color palette and we really restricted it, so it was like a bunch of neutral colors, which kind of, I think, helps create a kind of aesthetic cohesion. But also, when you walk down the streets of New York, it is kind of, there's a lot of black and
very monotone.
Neutral. Yeah, very
monotone.
You know, like, which is different than Los Angeles, which is like, you know, there's a bombastic bouquet of colors everywhere you go. And so that was a real specific visual choice to help create a more cohesive palette and world.
But what you also do when you do use color, and I think the most significant point in the film, is when Thomas is going down the alley and he's silhouetted and you've got WF sitting on the couch in that, with that beautiful eye-popping graffitied wall behind him and the bright sunlight coming down.
Yeah.
And at that moment, he's really walking into, you look at it and all you think of, he is finally, he's seeing the light. He is walking into life.
Yeah, something more colorful, literally.
That, I can honestly say, the single most powerful moment in that film.
Oh, that little confession there.
That little thing.
We found that in the randomly in the back of that building where we shot the apartments. It was this great little, I mean, that happens every once in a while. You go those little air pockets in the back of the tenements. It's just a beautiful little yard there that was left alone, but it was also a gallery of really incredible art.
I mean, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And for that moment in the film, for Thomas's world to open up, it was just pure. And I'm thinking, did they set dress that?
No, we had to get permission from the graffiti artist.
Did David design this? Yeah. You know,
he found it, but we had to go hunt down the graffiti artist to get their permission to put it in the movie, which was a chore.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, how difficult was it? Because these are out of the way places that you picked for your locations. How hard was it to find them?
Well, we wanted to shoot in New York. That was just a rule that we had for ourselves, and predominantly in Manhattan. We shot a couple scenes in Brooklyn. But it wasn't that hard. I mean, I lived there now. So, like, I would go walk down a street and find a place. I would, oh, this is the right vibe. And then and David Groban also lives in New York. So we all knew the city well enough to kind of identify things that felt right to us. And you know, we tried to shoot in the Met for the wedding, but we couldn't get it, so we went to the museum for that, which I had scouted for other things before. So it was kind of a, like, when you live in New York and you pay attention to things, it reveals itself to you in really interesting ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you captured all of them. And then, of course, the fact that you and Stuart, you go for a lot of crane shots, a lot of overhead.
Well,
looking
yeah.
down, it works.
So that was the, you know, in Gifted, for example, it was more of a naturalistic mm-hmm. vibe, and that was to kind of try to cut against the sentimental nature of the story, and to give it a kind of a realistic vibration. And you're in a you know, in Florida, and you want it to feel a little bit more raw. This story, again, was more of a fable. Like, there's a fantastical element to it. So, in terms of the camera work and the visual component of it, I wanted it to feel, you know, more elevated. Mm-hmm. You know, and we did a couple things. One is we would shoot through things. We kind of create boxes, and it was a sort of a way to make things more theatrical. Like, you're looking through a proscenium.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? To elevate or to stylize the world a little bit more. But also those shots that when you're making a movie and it's told at eye level, things tend to feel a little bit more realistic.
Mm-hmm.
And this, again, I wanted there to be a pleasure to the visuals and a mm-hmm. style to the visuals that spoke to a kind of fantastical quality mm-hmm. of the story.
Well, if it helps you. I put whimsical moments.
Uh-huh. I love it. Yes.
So, you know, that really comes through. And, of uh-huh. course, you set the tone with the opening titles. The book is being illustrated as you have yeah. Jeff Bridges doing the voiceover, yeah. starting to narrate
uh-huh.
what becomes this story.
Yeah, yeah.
So you start out with that charm and whimsy, and then you carry it through with the polished fantastical
yeah.
through the film.
Yeah.
And once again, you shot on 35.
Yep. Anamorphic 35mm film. Yeah.
What is it that keeps you shooting on 35?
Because, well, I think for TV, digital is really can be really mm-hmm. fantastic, and on some networks, it's a requirement. But film, when you are dealing with highlights, it tends to react to sunlight and backlight in a more rich way. I also think it's have a nostalgic connection to it. You know, it's how I started off making stuff, is always shooting on film, and there's a sacred quality to when the camera goes on, you know, and everybody's alert. Everybody was surprised that we were shooting on film. But when you say action, it puts an extra kind of pressure on the actors and a focus, which I really enjoy, and I think mm-hmm. it does have an impact on the performance.
Yeah, because I know so many actors that I talk to, and I'll ask them, how do they like, especially veteran actors, mm-hmm. like Pierce,
yeah,
you know, who started in film,
mm-hmm.
and with the transition.
Mm-hmm.
Sam Elliott's another one that all
yeah.
of a sudden, he'd never done anything but film,
yeah.
and he said, it's like a whole new world, and actors that are used to shooting digitally,
yeah.
they figure, well, if we don't get it in the first take, you know, we can do it again.
Yeah.
And that mindset is there. Like, you want people sharp,
uh-huh.
and you don't want to. Just because you can do it 50 times
yeah.
doesn't mean it's not costing money.
Yeah. And digital, I think, can be good for, and has been exploited in a positive way for comedy, like for improvisational
yeah.
comedy and like getting people into, and that's really great. And but that's not really what we were doing here.
Right.
You know, it was highly rehearsed and carefully constructed scenes, you know, and everybody, I mean, Jeff is such a pro, like he dials in very, very quickly, and everybody kind of, and Pierce as well, like these guys are just, you know, the most consummate professional.
You know, it's just for me to see the progression
yeah.
of the industry and the progression of these actors who are still around.
Yeah, Pierce is just what an icon, and what a gentle soul.
Oh, truly. But you know, then you get, I'm watching Jeff Bridges, and all I could think of is the dude meets Hemingway meets J.D. Salinger.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah, he's like, he really embraced that. And like, he, you know, he paid attention to every detail of that character. And he I think he looked at some Bukowski stuff, and that informed a little bit of his speech patterns, and you know, how he did his hair was kind of like Sam Beckett. And like, you know, he really dove into that world and the references around it. And it was pretty fun to get to experience that with him.
Now, you've been attached to this project for a long time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I for several years, but I was doing Spider-Man when it came about, and I was like, it would be so much fun to do a little movie. And I thought maybe I could do it between the first and the second Spider-Man, but you know, we just rolled from one to the other, so it had to go on the back burner, and then Gifted came together a little bit more quickly, and I had an optional picture to do at Fox, so this kind of was sitting there. Unfortunately, the stars aligned, and literally the stars aligned, and Pierce and Jeff and Kate all came aboard, and Cynthia, and it just ended up working.
Mm-hmm. And of course, then you get a find like Callum.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I saw him in the green room.
Oh yeah, great. That he played the lead singer. Yeah,
I saw him in there. But to see what he does here and what you bring out of him, mm-hmm. we actually see him mature on screen as the film progresses.
Yeah, he's sort of got a nascent masculinity, which is kind of hard to find. It's just there's a window in a young actor's career and that this role works where this can work, where he's, you know, he can be put on his heels by someone like Kiersey or Mimi, you know, but then in the next minute you're still rooting for him to get with someone like Kate, and that is it's a tricky Venn diagram to find the overlap. Mm-hmm. You know, and fortunately we found him. I mean, if they're too boyish, it doesn't quite work.
Yeah.
But if they're just all, if it's Jason Statham, you know, the first part of it doesn't work. You know what I mean? So you need to find that intermediate phase, and Callum is a supple enough actor to be able to kind of occupy both those spaces.
Well, and what's so great is that in his performance, he starts out very insecure, very boyish, very lost.
Mm-hmm.
But we see that emotional and physical progression.
Mm-hmm.
So that by the time you see him in bed with Kate,
mm-hmm.
you've got you and Stuart, you've got the camera set, so he's looking kind of buff, and
yeah.
it's like, okay, this is not the same kid that we were watching mooning over Mimi.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he's that scene where he's talking to her in the wedding, where he's mm-hmm. kind of confronting her, he is getting in touch with his anger there. And he's becoming a little... That is like the beginning... He's a different person at the beginning of that speech mm-hmm. than he is at the end of that speech.
Yeah. You know, what was it like working with Amazon on this one?
So great.
Relatively new.
Yeah.
New formatting, new style, new approach.
Yes, but Ted Hope is an old school independent producer from New York. So it's very... He's collaborative in a wonderful way, but very protective. They were the easiest people I've dealt with in terms of the studio environment, and you know, they were just great. They're fantastic, thoughtful, but incredibly supportive, and I think they know that there's a space for these little movies that they don't have to necessarily have to perform that well in the box office, but they have a life on
mm-hmm.
you know, I think people are enjoying these movies more and more in their homes, and I think that is really helpful for something like this.
I mean, I guarantee you this is the kind of film that if it is on cable,
uh-huh.
I mean, I'll definitely buy it on Blu-ray when it comes out because I want it.
Yeah.
But this is the kind of film that if it is on cable and I'm flipping channels and
yeah.
I would see this, I
yeah.
would stop and watch it every
yeah.
time.
Oh, great.
It's great. That, I mean, there is that much in this film that makes it so enjoyable. Every character is just as interesting as the next.
Yeah.
And the dynamic that interweaves amongst all of them
yeah.
is so beautifully done.
Oh, great. Wow, thank you.
That's... You tie everything up. We have no loose ends.
Mm-hmm.
The film ends on such a hopeful, upbeat, happy note.
Yeah.
All the way around.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was, I mean, I left the theater smiling.
Great.
When I saw it.
Yeah.
We don't see enough films that have this golden age of Hollywood happy ending.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, hopefully it's a little bit complicated, but I think
it was complicated getting there, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, there's a price to pay for that, I suppose, but yeah, that's good, I like that, yeah. It's a little bit more of an old school movie, isn't it?
Very
in
much
that
so.
Sense. Like, I think, again, I keep on thinking about that word fable. That's how we approached it, certainly.
Yeah, and it works.
Yeah.
It works.
Yeah.
But, you know, something that you do exceedingly well. You did this in 500 Days of Summer, and I know this is because of your music video background. The music here is,
yeah.
Oh my God, Mark.
Yeah.
I thought I was in love with what Oren Moverman did with his soundtrack
mm-hmm.
with The Dinner.
Mm-hmm.
I now have to tell mm-hmm. Oren, I like this one better.
I think, well, there's a fun part of it where you just, there's a few elements. Well, the score, which Rob Simonson, my favorite thing that Rob did was was in that, during that speech. Originally, we temped that. We tried to find music, but I couldn't make any... Songs didn't work because the vocals competed with what the guy was saying. And I temped in Umeji's theme from In the Mood for Love to like give it that kind of... It was a waltz. It was a 3-4 time thing. But then we tried to compose something like that and it never worked. So then Rob was like, let's do a tango, which gave it a mystery but also a sexiness, which I think really ended up working well for that section. And Rob was, I think, did a, it's one of my favorite scores he's ever done. And I've worked with him a lot. But then there's the actual needle drops. And it was so much fun to work with, you know, Mingus and Simon and Garfunkel, obviously, Blues Around the Game and Only Living Boy in New York, Dylan, but also Brubeck and, you know, the Paloma Azul, like that sort of lazy mid-century jazz feel. Yeah. It was so much fun to play around with that palette, which is different, way different than the pop music of 500 Days of Summer or even the Spider-Man movies or the southern twang of Gifted. It was trying to identify the texture through the music.
How hard was it to find the specific needle drops that you used? And then
it wasn't,
to get the
I never
licensing.
Thought about it as hard. It was really fun, and you know, Randall Poster, who's our music supervisor, was instrumental in that. But a lot of it, I just over the course of the years, I would listen to think about sequences and just, oh, this song will work there. Let me try this, or let me try this. Also, the actors, like Jeff, when we were doing that scene in the apartment with Jeff and Callum, he brought in his own soundtrack, and that's a Bill Evans piece called Peace, which is just this beautiful, very simple piece of music that Jeff actually taught me how to play on the piano. He's a total musician too.
Oh,
so
yeah.
He's like, that was how he viewed this scene and this character, and I loved incorporating that kind of that element in the movie, you know? It was really fun. It's a great way to connect with your actor.
So beautiful with the music is you have something that is reflective of each one of your main characters, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Mimi has a kind of a new attitude. Johanna has Visions of Johanna. I mean, the movie really could be called Visions of Johanna, but it's like Johanna's vision of how the world works. Like, she's such a catalyst for how things move forward. You know, that kind of beat poetry thing, that backbeat jazz quality, I think really fits well with Jeff, and of course that Dylan feels very much like him. But yeah, they all had kind of this attitude, and I mean the movie is told from the perspective of Thomas primarily, even though it feels a little bit like an ensemble, it really is told from his perspective. So there is a gimlet-eyed view of New York that he embraces that I think the music supports. That was the intention of that.
You know, how much rehearsal time? Because you mentioned rehearsal, and I know that Cynthia has mentioned in the past about it was a luxury for her to have rehearsal time. Because on a lot of these indie films, you don't get rehearsal time.
Cynthia came on very late in the game, and so we didn't get to rehearse with her very much. But we had about a week or 10 days worth of rehearsals with Jeff. And what was fun with Jeff was we went to the actual locations and went to the rooms where we were going to shoot stuff and like gave him the props, and so there was a lot of time for him to marinate, and that I think had a huge impact on. I mean that's what he likes to do, and I love it when actors like to rehearse. And he was so collaborative but also respectful. He became a wonderful partner. I mean, I wish we could always have that much time to spend.
How exciting is it for you as a director? Because after Jeff and Hell or High Water last year, he is on such a high with the public, and I know people are chomping at the bit for this film. Is this really, you mentioned the stars aligning.
Yeah.
Is this another aspect of the stars aligning that may help put
literally
this
the
film?
Stars aligned, Like, I mean, the 11th commandment should be, thou shalt make a movie with Jeff Bridges. Because it's just a wonderful experience, and I'm so lucky. I just assumed he was going to pass, but he liked the script. It was a wonderful surprise, total surprise. But it was like, as soon as I heard he was interested, I did everything in my power to like make everything work.
Did he do one of his picture books for you?
I haven't seen the picture book yet,
but he did it.
I don't know. I mean, he had his camera. So he was always shooting.
He does it with every film he's
really?
In.
Oh, I can't wait to see it.
He takes pictures. I actually have a couple of the books that he actually...
Really?
Autographed ones that he did at a couple press days.
Oh, cool.
Probably about, 8, 9 years ago. But yeah, he takes the pictures and then puts them together for the cast and crew and maybe for some press. So I mean, God, I would kill to see the pictures for this film.
Yeah. They've I mean, he was definitely taking pictures. There's no doubt about it. But I have not seen it.
So now you've got the two smaller films back to back. You're going to keep doing these gorgeous little gems, or are you going to go back into the bigger blockbuster tentpoles?
I don't know. I think I'd like to. It just depends on the story. I like making big movies. I like making small movies. I don't have to think about it in those terms. It's just like what I think. I want to be very careful about the scripts and really understanding the pathway to success for the movie. And I think it takes time. I'm much more comfortable now making movies slowly and spending time to get things right and the script right. And I think I have a little less sense of urgency now than I did when I was 33 and trying to get a movie made, you know? So in that sense, that's really the important component to me, not whether it's big or small.
Well, I can't wait to see what you do next, Mark.
Thank you.
I am so in love with this film. I love
thank
Gifted.
You.
And now, and 500 Days of Summer when that came out.
Yeah, thanks. Those are really fun movies to make. I got really lucky with those.
But this one, it just swept me off my feet with its charm.
Oh, thank you. That's great to hear. I'm really, really happy
that
you enjoyed it. I hope people like it. We'll see. You never know.